Hey everybody, welcome to this week's Bald Movie. We are going over a strangely topical film for a movie that came out almost a decade ago. 2011's Contagion, directed by Steven Soderbergh, written by Scott Z. Burns. You're probably familiar with a lot of Steven Soderbergh's work. Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Out of Sight, Aaron Brockovich, Traffic, Ocean's 11, Magic Mike, High Flying Bird, the 2019 basketball film. Shot entirely on an iPhone. Yeah. Right. Scott Z. Burns, I wasn't as familiar with, but I knew his works, Born Identity, The Informant, which is a collaboration between Matt Damon himself and Steven Soderbergh. The Report, which is a movie I want to see last year about the torture report that came out after 9/11. And he's also writing No Time to Die, the upcoming Bond film. So that's pretty cool. And his movie stars so many people. You got Marion Cotillard, Matt Damon, Larry Fish, Lawrence Fishburne, Judy Law, Gwyneth Paltrow, Katie Winslet. I can't do Brainy Cranston, and Jennifer Ellie. What did you think of this film? Just as a, I think before, unlike me, had seen this movie before all this shit come out. What did you think of it then? What do you think of it now? I'm interested in that.
I liked it both times around. I think this time I was watching with a little extra spice, given the circumstances. But yeah, I mean, it's a really well-crafted film. And the thing that hooked me the first time around was sort of the real in-depth look at, you know, how this thing spreads, how you can get your kind of arms around it and sort of contain this thing or deal with this thing. And it's something that not a lot of other movies have done in this detail.
Yeah.
And so when I saw it, I was just sort of blown away by what seemed to be like the most, the closest examination of something like this that I've ever seen.
And it felt very plausibly real. And the amazing thing is how it feels very real in the context of the first worldwide pandemic that I've lived through. Like the broad now, and we're going to, this is going to be an interesting kind of review because of one half of it's going to be just about the movie itself. And then we're going to talk about the differences between the fictional virus MEV1 and the very real coronavirus, the COVID-19 virus. Because I think there's two reactions when people see this film is like, you know, that's bad. And also like, oh, my God, what if this is the apocalypse? Because COVID-19 is not as bad as this fictional MEV1.
Yeah, like, not even close.
Yeah, like this fictional virus is like a combination Ebola plus influenza. And so far, knock on wood, we haven't seen a bug like that. But we'll talk about that. I thought maybe I just for a person that had never seen it before, I got this confused with Outbreak. And I was expecting a lot.
I've seen that too.
I was expecting a lot more monkeys biting and Dustin Hoffman, but this is a much better film. Outbreak is pretty silly. This is actually a really, really good film. And I learned in researching that Scott Z. Burns spent a lot of time researching with medical experts, such as Ian Lipkin, who served as primary like medical advisor in this film and is currently suffering from the coronavirus. What an ironic life that guy must be leading right now.
Jesus. Well, I hope he recovers.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, like just from an art and review aspect, like any movie that has Gwyneth Paltrow in it and she dies 10 minutes into the film, 10 out of 10. 10 out of 10. It's a perfect film. It just gets better from there.
The soundtrack is also really amazing in this. Like the score. There's something about the score that isn't like doomsday. It's not droning kind of like doom at all times, but it's also it conveys a certain sense of urgency, but like a hopeful urgency.
I
don't know how to describe it. It's just like it's like this synthetic sort of,
here's the two words I was going to describe it: meticulous and precise, which I feel like underscored the action, because most of the action is filmed such as it is researchers and virologists just desperately trying to keep one step ahead of this thing. Yeah. And their work has to be that way. Like they have to, like, we'll talk about this in a bit, but like, you know, wearing those, you know, BSL level 4 outfits has got to be just hell and working those. And I've read a firsthand, There's been a lot of like threads where people have shared their experience working with other viruses during this pandemic, and one guy who was on the front lines of the Ebola outbreak the last time said, you know, on touching his face, it's like you've never been aware of how often you touch your face than when you're working in a hemorrhagic fever lab with just a mask and no goggles, and you're fighting a 2-hour eye itch that you can't, okay. You know, you can't stop what you're doing to do it. And it's, I thought that was really interesting.
I thought you were talking about being in the full hazmat suit and just like reaching up and bumping the visor.
That's, yeah, that's like where you just can't even do it. Yeah. But all these considerations that came up in this film, the economy, shutting down the schools, what are you going to do with kids? Like, these are things that we see people debating in real time right now. And I thought that was fascinating.
I will say, I think the one portion of the devastation that this movie is lacking severely in is the economy, given what we've seen so far with the COVID stuff. It is just a very surface level sort of economic angle on this. Like, they mention it, I think, but it's never really dealt with. Like, you see a line where people are being handed out MREs and right. stuff like that, but they don't go into depth on that. They stay much more focused on like the containment and putting the kibosh on this virus.
I mean, you do see like there's hoarding and runs on things, which if anything, I think this movie undersold. Based on what we've seen with Corona, and you see like looting, and you see people like trying to steal supplies and whatnot. So it's like you get the idea that things are pretty desperate. I mean, anytime that the military is feeding civilian populations with, you know, mm-hmm. these meals ready to eat, it's got to be hell. But you're right, they don't. There's nothing about the stock market. There's nothing about how people are, you know, affording their rent and their houses and et cetera. None of that stuff. I think one of the things that works, like, and Soderbergh is so good at using light and sound to just convey, this whole film conveys a feeling of sickliness and unhealth. Like mm-hmm. those green washes, the blue washes, there's always coughing in the background. You know, as you see people shaking hands and then returning to, you know, like it all starts in this city in Asia, and then you see them flying back, and you go to London and there's a population of like 16 million. I'm just going to make up numbers, and New York and Minneapolis and all these places where you just see like this is where a virus is going to, you know, have all these hosts spread through. Because I think mm-hmm. that's one thing that people get wrong is like people act like the virus spreads. The virus doesn't spread shit. The virus doesn't have wings. It doesn't have legs. Humans are what spread the virus. Mm-hmm. The virus can make things easier or harder to spread, but like we are the ones that spread it. And I feel like this movie in the first 10 minutes did just such a great job of showing how quickly this can get out of hand and kind of how...
Yeah.
Somewhat silly, the pointing at fingers about which country this started in ultimately is like did China handle everything correctly? Should they tried suppressing this information for a month? No, but you know, worldwide everyone knew what was going on by the time end of January is, and yet much of the world did nothing. Most of the world mm-hmm. did nothing. So it's like, you know, it's I thought that was really great.
They use a lot of close-ups in this movie of different items, like you know, people touching railings or like glasses, things like that, that really convey like they don't do like an overlay, right, where you can see, oh, here's like a bunch of red splotches or something, but you feel
you
it
just know.
You still you understand
they got them fomites.
I learned what fomites are. I'm surprised I haven't heard more in the news about fomites.
Yeah, lately. Especially with this being in, like, because this contagion's getting another life, obviously, in the last couple weeks of everyone renting it. That's how I kind of thought of doing this, is the first night of our real lockdown, where the governor said, hey, we're shutting everything down. I'm like, fuck it. I'm just going to watch this thing, see what happens. And, I'm surprised there's not more people talking about fomites. Because that's the real danger here with COVID-19, it seems like. You know, person to person, obviously, and touching things other people have touched. The other thing, besides the cinematography that they do to convey this sense of sickliness and unhealth and desperation, is how just utterly unsentimental it is about its characters. Mm-hmm. Like, Gwyneth Paltrow dies foaming at the mouth, and then later you see her head being split open. the thing that happens with Kate Winslet's arc, you know, that like this is a main character, but like how unceremoniously her plot line ends. There, I read some analysis about how this is a modern trend in filmmaking they call hyperlinked cinema. Did you see any of that discussion?
No, I don't know what that is.
Where you assemble a narrative out of like a half dozen disparate plot lines. Like you've got the Matt Damon stuff, you've got the Dr. Cheever stuff, you've got the Mears stuff, you've got the Marion Cotillard stuff, which is, I think, bizarre.
But yeah, it's like World War Z, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like you just have all this threaded kind of thing that you're kind of like the narrative emerges from all these individual stories that you're telling, and they all start and end at different times. They're not like they don't have a definitive like conclusion. And I thought that was pretty interesting. Soderbergh also used that in like the movie Traffic. This hyperlink cinema type thing, but I think that does a real, you know, that feels like, you know, a real kind of plague situation that, you know, the heroes don't necessarily all live and the villains don't necessarily get punished.
Most movies, like speaking of the Kate Winslet storyline here, most movies would have her be in that like 3/4 of people who recover from this thing. This movie doesn't. This movie just, and I think they wanted to convey like what a danger this thing is to the healthcare workers who are actively fighting it.
And we've seen that like worldwide, there's been numerous documented cases of doctors and nurses succumbing to this thing already. And some of it, like I saw this kid in Pakistan who's 27, graduated from med school like 2 years ago, and you know died already from COVID. So it's not necessarily just the sick and the old that this disease is taking. I want to say that like from here on out we're going to do tons and tons and tons of spoilers. If you haven't seen this film, I think it's a great film to watch with the caveat of this is much, much worse than coronavirus. And I hope if you watch it, you then come back and listen to the second half of our podcast where we'll talk about the important differences and similarities between the disease, because it's I also don't want people to walk away and be like, oh, well, it's not as bad as MEV1, so we don't have to worry about it. Because I think both of those lessons, like this is hopeless, we're all going to die, versus this is not a big deal, it's okay, both of those are ignorant opinions, let's say. I want to talk about specifics in this movie, and I want to start with like Matt Damon. He was deliberately cast as his utility in this kind of everyman type of role. He's a husband that loses his wife, and then his stepson, within a single day, he's stuck in the situation where he can't bury them or have a funeral because the quarantine is on, which is something that we're seeing reflected in, like, you know, Italy especially. I just thought that he was really good. Like, when the nurse and doctor try to tell him that his wife is dead, he just not registering. Like, how can that be?
I was with her 2 hours ago. She was sick, but she wasn't dead.
And then
losing his son, like, and then being reunited with his daughter was another outstanding scene, I thought. You know, through the glass, not actually reunited.
I also thought that his daughter was a pretty good portrayal of a fairly smart with a teenager. Like, this is like, she sees how serious this is. It's a very big bummer, but also she's a teenager and she wants to kiss her boyfriend. And Matt Damon has to break that up at the point of a shotgun.
Yeah. They do an excellent job with Matt Damon. Speaking of him being sort of an everyman stand in here, of not giving us any idea of who he is really, or what he does. Like, we see that he's taking this very seriously. And he seems to be a very meticulous person, but like, we don't know if he's an accountant or a programmer or if he's a rock star. Like, we don't fucking know. And I think that goes a long way toward you being able to put yourself in his shoes.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like he's kind of comfortably middle class, but other than that, you're right. We don't know. And I thought that was really good. I loved the relationship between him and his daughter, and the scene, like, you know, when him trying to recreate her prom or give her a prom. So this is, I thought that was kind of neat, and it's something that I've been thinking about. I think this coronavirus stuff is got different levels of realization. Like, I know the first time I realized that, oh, God, this isn't actually going to be one of those media hype deals is when they, like, canceled the NBA. That was the day that I'm like, shit, this is actually going to be a real fucking deal. But I'm watching young people now, especially kind of realize like, oh God, I might not have a graduation ceremony. I might not even graduate. I might have to, am I going to have to, and like college kids, like there's, you know, various rites of passage that you can do as a young person, and they only kind of come around once. There's going to be a whole generation of kids that are deprived of those experiences. And people are starting to realize that and really mourn that, which I think, you know, is a very human thing and something that this show, this movie had time to kind of honor. I think that as far as plot, that they did a really good job of showing that how much of this epidemiologist's job is detective work. Like, it's vital to track down where the initial infection came from, how it was spread. Was it spread by, you know, aerosol? Was it spread by cough droplets? Was it person-to-person contact? Was it person-to-object contact? Because all those things, like, they're what they're trying to do is figure out, you know, where it came from so they can analyze the virus and grow more of it so they can study and find a vaccine. But they're also trying to figure out what the R-naught value is, which we'll talk about in detail here in a bit. But just, like, you know, how it's just... It reminded me a lot of like a crime film, and that you've got these like experts and like law enforcement, and they're going through closed caption footage and going through credit card receipts, just trying to figure out where all these people have been and who they've been in contact with.
Yeah, that's really good. I like some of the more detailed explanation about how viruses are examined as well. Like when in that scene when, shit, who is it that's explaining? Is it Kate Winslet explaining to someone, like walking them through the 3D model of the virus and how it attaches to human cells?
I thought that was Jennifer Ellie, but...
Was it? Okay, yeah. I can't quite remember, but I was so fixated on like their model there. It was really neat because like I don't really know how that stuff works. It's not super important when you're a layperson sort of dealing with this, but it was a nice insight.
Yeah, it's cool because like I'm with you. I don't understand fully how it works, but I know that like viruses have various attachment points that are like shaped like Legos, if we're going to use an example. And like we have receptors in our human body. And sometimes those, you know, we have, you know, that's the reason like a virus that affects cows might not necessarily affect a human because it doesn't have the right protein attachments to actually start, you know, making more of itself. And when those things change, you get a novel virus that humans don't have any natural antibodies to. Those are like parts of our Lego kit, and our immune system doesn't have any kind of way to interface with it. And that's kind of the problem with this MEV1 and also the coronavirus, is that it's a completely new strain that we don't have any natural defenses against. We don't have any vaccines for. And that makes it really tricky. And they communicated that really well. I thought just the mismatch in mindset between like Kate Winslet's character Mears and everyone that she meets, like she knows how serious this is from day one. And she is wrangling like she's setting up emergency hospitals, and she's got city council people coming and be like, hey, is this coming out of your budget or ours?
Right.
Definitely. We're seeing the early stages of that haggling in our government. And, you know, it's her character is very ironic because she pays for her diligence with her life. And the irony of her, like, suffering in this field hospital that she herself set up. She's going to die here alone, you know, surrounded by other dying people in this sterile, giant warehouse stadium
buried
facility.
Buried in a mass grave.
And then, yeah, like, that's how sentimental it was. Like, the next time we see her, she's getting a plastic bagged up because they've run out of body bags, duct taped around the neck and thrown into a pit. Like, it's fucking wild. It is weird, though, that like the CDC specialist is just open mouth coughing everywhere. Like when she's dealing with another guy, like, you know, same thing when the one Jennifer Ellie, the doctor who injects herself with the vaccine, goes to visit her dad. Her dad's like, you shouldn't be here. It's not safe. You know, it's like, I mean, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I see what you're doing, doctor. And there's a mismatch there. That's another good example, I guess, of hyperlinked storytelling is, did we ever meet her dad at all?
Just that one scene.
Or was it like, we didn't need to, we understand. And she provided the like, well, the only reason you're here is because you're a brave, selfless doctor, et cetera, et cetera.
They also try and deal with the panic aspect of this a little bit. And that's around like Larry Fish telling his wife that like something bad is happening here. We need to get out of the city and come to Atlanta. And she tells, of course, a friend. She can't help but tell a friend. And that sort of spreads, right? And this panic starts.
When I watched this film about 2 weeks ago, I got to this part where Lawrence Fishburne is telling his girlfriend, I think, not wife, girlfriend.
Is it? Okay.
I wasn't sure that you need to get out. Like, they're about to shut down Illinois and Chicago. You need to get out of here and get to Atlanta as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what are the ethics and morality of that? Because I guess it's one of those things where, like, I think it's wrong because of what could have happened and what did happen. Her tell a friend who've told a friend, and now you've got wide-scale panic and people fleeing the city when you're trying to contain it. Mm-hmm. But also, like, it's a very human impulse. Like, you're trying to save the person, you know, like, it's a tragedy that 20 million people die, but it's a whole different level of tragedy when it's your wife or it's your son or your mother or father, right? So I was thinking, like, okay, I guess using inside information, if you are literally at the forefront of fighting it, like, it's understandable, but it's still transgressive.
Yes.
And then I read about these fuckers who literally were doing inside trading. The CEO of the New York Stock Exchange, Jeff Sprecher, his wife, Senator Kelly Loeffler, Senator Richard Burr, get out of this classified briefing on how bad this thing is going to be, make phone calls to sell their stock. Meanwhile, they're telling to the public, this is no big deal. We're going to get through this. It's not going to cause any disruption. Apparently, this isn't illegal. But, like, if I had a more...
How is that possible?
Man, it's one of those things where, like, you should be able to... I don't know. Because one of the bed...
Can we get a retroactive law in here?
One of the bedrocks of our justice system is, no, you can't do that. But holy shit, I can't believe you can't find some kind of statute to bring them up on. Because, like, you can imagine if I had... you can imagine if I had an ethical problem with Lawrence Fishburne's actions, like how fucking pissed off I was to find out. Also, like, guys who were trying to price gouge on bleach wipes and antibiotic, what was that, the hand sanitizer stuff, they're getting prosecuted and they got their entire stocks confiscated. Like, how the hell is this any different? How the hell is it different?
It might be a good time to note this podcast is probably going to get fairly political at some point.
Yes, because life annoyingly does that from time to time.
So, you know, buckle up.
Yeah, and you compare that to, like, Jude Law's character, who
which is in real life happening right now. I mean, you look at what Alex Jones did when this whole thing started up. He, you know, and in this movie, we get some sort of justice for that. There's very much a reckoning.
They at least make a effort. Yeah.
Yeah.
He gets bailed out. And
In real life, things aren't always so nice and neat. Yeah. And, you know, there are some disgusting people out there who are taking advantage of this situation in reprehensible ways. And I don't know that we will see them get forsythia'd by the end of this.
Yeah, I wish there was a way. And I think that's, like, we also, there's a lot more important things to do right now. But, like, I don't know that we should forget about this, because if we let this slide, that it's going to happen the next time. It's going to happen even worse. Like, people are like,
we should certainly not.
Yeah, like, we're punishing people that are hoarding. We're punishing people that are price gouging. We should fucking definitely prosecute the people that swore an oath to protect and defend us for profiteering on that. Like, there should be. And I think there will be. I want to talk about Jude Law's character, Alan. Why do they give Jude Law bad teeth?
I have no idea.
Like,
I think they want him to look... They don't want him to be so perfect.
That's,
because Jude Law's a very handsome man, and I think they just wanted him to, like, have something off and something repulsive.
But I don't... That, to me, that's not real life. Like, these people I just talked about, Richard Burr, Jeff Sprecher, Kelly Loeffler, they don't look like ghouls. They look like presentable, professional people. They smile. They have nice teeth. They have nice hair. They have nice clothes.
I just want to say I'm not saying anybody with less than perfect teeth is a monster.
No.
I'm simply saying Jude Law looks so perfect as a human being that it's hard to, like, giving him a weird tooth sort of says everything you need to say, I guess.
Yeah.
About his personality in a weird way in filmmaking, right?
Yeah, I just thought, I think it's that's one of the few flaws in the film is that, you know, because they obviously show this guy as like, you're supposed to think he's a clown, but I think he's obviously smart and resourceful. He is one of the classic example of a person that's very, very smart, very, very intelligent, but is wasting all of that on bad input.
Yeah. He's manipulating people. He's selfish. He's greedy.
And he's pushing this Forsythia cure that he's profiting personally from. And I want to compare and contrast this guy to, as you mentioned, Alex Jones. But I want to talk about our president, President Trump, who has been for the last week, you know, hailing this miracle cure, chloroquine,
which just killed a couple people.
Well, it's not even that. Like, these people, like, heard chloroquine, they realize, oh, that's something that's in our aquarium supplements that we use to treat our tropical fish. I'll take that. It's, but they took chloroquine phosphate when the cure, if it is a cure, is hydroxychloroquine. And if you don't understand the difference, sodium explodes when it touches water, and chlorine is an absolute poison that will fucking kill you, but sodium chlorine is table salt. Like, this fundamental scientific misunderstanding is behind anti-vaxxers, because they don't understand the difference between an amalgamated or stabilized form of mercury compounds versus just fucking drinking mercury. Right. They don't understand, like, this is the classic dihydrogen monoxide, you know? It's like, oh, a teaspoon, inhaled a teaspoon can kill you. It's fucking water. It's just water.
Right.
But, like, these people hear Trump say that, oh, we got this miracle cure. They go to something that sounds like it. They take it, and one of them's dead, and the other's in critical care. Like, and, you know, the interview of this man's wife, the survivors, said just exactly, well, we heard President Trump talk it out, and we trust him, and there's no other drugs approved for it, so why not? Well, this is why. And this is the kind of dangerous misinformation. This film... Yeah. Postulated would be spread on the internet through dodgy sites, and unfortunately it's being spread at national press conferences with our own president. It's wild stuff, man. So another kind of real life counterpart here is that at one point Bryan Cranston comes off as kind of an asshole about not rescuing Mears, because Lawrence Fishburne wanted to send, I guess, a special CDC ship with the capsule that's got a like quarantine facility to rescue her, and they'd already used it on a senator. There has been a little bit of debate about whether if cures or treatments or vaccines are produced, should they go to like first responders first? Should they go to politicians first? I think that's a lot, because like a lot of people were on one side or the other firmly. I think that's a really hard decision, because, you know, especially in a case like this where it was like had an R value north of 4 or R not value north of 4 and was killing 1 out of 4 people. Continuity of government is really important during a crisis.
Yeah. I think that there are, I don't know, my opinion is that the first responders and healthcare workers should absolutely get this first when we come up with a vaccine for it, because they're the ones who are risking their lives doing this. And the more of them we can save, the better off we'll all be. And I think, yes, you're right, there is a continuity of government that is important, but those people are easier. Those people can do their jobs without much human contact, whereas first responders are all human contact jobs. There's really no way to say, hey, we can safely do this job without being immune to the disease.
They also show things like Elliot Gould is running this research hospital out in California, and he defies an order from the CDC to continue working on the virus, and turns out he's right. How did you feel about that?
Mixed. You know, he got the results, and he probably sped up the whole process of understanding and finding a cure for the disease, but also it was a very risky thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if things had gone wrong, he could have created a much worse problem.
It reminds me of like the terrorism examples in like 24, where like Jack Bauer is shoving a towel down someone's esophagus and ripping their throat out. If he stops a literal nuclear bomb, he's probably a hero. If he doesn't, he's just a fucking outlaw, you know?
I think that behavior should be strongly discouraged, though. I don't know how strongly I want to punish it. It's I don't know. That's
the way it's like. So let's say that like that charge of defying a CDC order and working with biohazards would be like a 2-year jail term. I think that's fair, because if I'm Elliot Gould and I'm in that position, maybe, and I feel like I'm really right, I want to roll the dice, and then, like, you know, like if it works and I save lives, then I can, what jury is going to convict me, number one, and number two, 2 years in jail is a pretty small price to pay to save millions and millions and millions of lives. Like, I feel like that's like...
Yeah, however, the price you could pay is to kill millions and millions of people.
To discourage people that don't want to go to jail?
No. I mean, if you fail in your goal and a catastrophe happens and this virus gets out into the general population, I think he's in San Francisco or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
He could have been the cause of many deaths.
I know one thing that we kind of debated on personally during this thing is like, how long will it take to get a vaccine, you know, through all of its different processes of approval, through all of the different, you know, regulations and rules, because it's, you know, as you just said, it's important not to, you know, that's physician's creed, right? Do no harm.
Yeah.
This movie depicts a single researcher injecting herself with a vaccine as kind of like clearing a lot of that red tape, apparently. And it also must be said that this virus is killing 1 out of 4 people. It's infecting tens of millions of people worldwide. Like, the risk calculations is a lot different than what it might be with coronavirus. But have you done any additional looking in since we had that discussion last week to see, like, what is, like, the absolute fastest we could develop a vaccine if we had one and we wanted to waive, like, all human trials and researchers shot themselves up and went in with the monkeys and proved the...
I mean, it seems to me that for something of this scope, this sort of transmissible, this deadly, I don't think you speed that up too much beyond the normal process. But the speed of the trials is not necessarily the problem here. It's also the speed of the manufacturing and distribution of the vaccine, and that in this movie is what takes so long. Like, even though a researcher goes in, finds a vaccine after 57 trials or whatever, injects herself, and suddenly we have the cure, which I don't think is realistic in the first place, but not a cure. A vaccine is not a cure. Now we have a vaccine for it. They still had to go produce that vaccine. They had to have a lottery system for who would get it because there wasn't enough of it yet. That took months and months and months, right? Just to distribute the thing.
It was like a 300-day, almost a year-long process to distribute the vaccine if we based on the lottery dates that they're talking about.
Right. And everything I've seen about the coronavirus says, all the experts say, look, it's going to be about a year at best before we have a true vaccine tested and ready to go, assuming everything goes right. And then how long it takes beyond that to manufacture and distribute, I don't know. The other concern with the vaccine is like the time of discovery, I guess, and the trials required to test and prove that it's actually a vaccine that works, and it's a vaccine that isn't going to kill more people or harm more people than it actually cures, than it actually prevents sickness in. That process takes a while, and it's usually a 3-round process. They do it with like a very small group, a few dozen people, to test a potential vaccine. They monitor them for about a year. They give them 2 shots over the course of a month of this stuff, and then monitor them for a year. And then round two is like a few hundred people tested. Round three is like a mass test of like typically thousands or tens of thousands of people. And as you can imagine, testing that many people takes a very long time. And they do this for really good reasons. first and foremost being to make sure that the cure isn't worse than the disease here, right?
Right.
As everybody's so fond of saying right now.
Right.
You have to know that this vaccine isn't going to do more harm than good. And so testing is super important. And to rush that process risks having a solution that is worse than the problem itself.
Yeah. Because, like, you know, vaccines are safe, but they do provoke, even the ones that are well known and tested, do provoke occasional allergic reactions in people. There's some people that it doesn't work on. Like, those are things, you know, if you had a disease that's killing one out of four people, but a vaccine trial kills one out of three, well, then obviously the cure is literally worse than the disease in that point. They had something interesting that also modeled what I see is happening, which is they had individual states shutting down their borders and ordering quarantine. Something that we're seeing right now, where at the federal government, we're not getting any kind of coordinated message or response. But in that vacuum, about one third of our states have stepped forward with shelter at home orders or some form of quarantine, limiting non-essential business, etc. There's this concept in America that was coined by a chief justice of the Supreme Court back about 100 years ago, where that states serve as laboratories of democracy.
Was it Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
It wasn't. It wasn't. She actually joined the court a year later in like 1916. But he said this this is a feature of America that like portion states can conduct radical or novel social experiments without putting the nation itself at harm. And it feels like that's what's happening, because I also just saw this morning Nate Silver, the head statistician from 538, that they're political, but they just analyze polls and popular opinion, and they make predictions and stat analysis and stuff. Early goings are that in states that are characterized as red states or conservative states, the rate of infection is 31%, and in blue states, through the first few weeks, it's at 20%. And to the extent that you can say that, like, the blue states are taking this more serious, they're more inclined to shut down, they're more populated, I think that's interesting in a laboratory of democracy sense. That we are, something I said to my father like 3 weeks ago, it's like, we're going to see firsthand all around the world what nations are equipped to deal with this and what nations aren't. And I just thought that was like, you know, the fact that Illinois is shut down even though the country itself hadn't, that was really interesting and predictive.
Yeah.
What did you think? I thought the end of the movie was bizarre too. Matt Damon going through his camera roll, and then they track the well-known bat, the pig, the chef, the Paltrow vector of diseases. I mean, there's disease experts around the world always talk about how you go from bat to Paltrow, and that's the worst. I thought that was an odd choice to end the movie with.
I kind of liked it. Because they never show us the inciting event, right? And this whole movie is a process of discovery, like trying to track that down. Like, where did it start? How do we fight this thing? How's it spread? And so to come back at the end and say this sort of simplest, most unpredictable thing is what started all this. I kind of found it, I don't know, poetic's not the right word, but just very, very satisfying to sort of come back to that and see it at the end.
Yeah. And that's something I think we'll get to in our outline as well, is that there's this, you know, you hear a lot about these open air wet markets in Asia. And I feel like that what people are envisioning is like people eating live bats and whatnot. But it's more of the case of things like this, where you just have like, it's a bat that was eating some tainted fruit, or was sick, dropping in a pig. And it just happened to be a strain that could jump to that species. And, you know, it wasn't anything in particularly, dirty or filthy, or out of any kind of like first world Western standards. It was just this happenstance. So maybe, I guess it was useful for that. I just thought it was a bizarre way to end the film in. You want to start talking about the disease?
Yeah. Cause you mentioned how this is sort of, you know, similar in a lot of ways to COVID, but also, different in many crucial ways.
Do you want to talk about the differences or the similarities first?
I want to talk mostly about the differences. If you have any similarities, go for it. But
okay, I want to talk about the differences too, because I feel like that's the thing will calm people down, or the similarities will ramp people up. So let's start with,
because I mean, there are a lot of similarities, right?
Yes,
many similarities. I think the way you narrow this conversation down is start talking about the things that are different.
Yeah,
and the things that are less upsetting about our current situation.
So let's talk about the difference between COVID-19 and MEV1.
Okay,
do you got one?
Yeah, the R-naught value.
All right, talk about it.
Which I will admit to not fully understanding how they determine the R-naught value. I don't know if it's based fully on that investigative sort of work they do, looking at camera footage and tracking that virus back to its sort of nexus. But yeah, this virus has an R-naught of 4, which is compared to, or maybe even north of 4 in the movie, the MEV-1, which is far higher, far, far greater than what we have with COVID. I think COVID is COVID 2, R2.
I've seen numbers between, I actually just wrote this down, that Empire report estimated it between 1.5 and 3.5.
Okay. So and you probably, go with the median, like 2.2.
Yeah,
something
the
like
most
that.
Common cited is 2.1 to 2.3. Okay. So can you explain to R-naught like what that means? Because there's, I think a lot of people might be like, the fuck is R-naught mean?
So in this movie, they explain it, and if you've seen it, you'll kind of understand it. But R-naught is essentially the number of people that an infected person will give it to over the course of their illness. And so when you have an R-naught of 2.25 or whatever, which we're talking about with coronavirus, it's you're going to go out to public and you're going to give it to 2.5 people or whatever, 2.25 people. They're all going to go out. They're going to give it to 2.25 people. And you sort of see how that exponentially increases. And it. And you have to understand that like an R-naught of 2.25 is exponentially better also than an R-naught of 4.
Yeah.
Because an R-naught of 4 is extreme.
Yes.
And you can see that if you just do like some back of the napkin calculations. Like, okay, say we have an R-naught of 2 and 3 steps on from one person getting it, you're at like 8, right?
Mm-hmm.
8 people have it. If you do that same calculation, 3 steps on from an R-naught of 4, you're at like 256. Mm-hmm. So like you can see how this compounds with the R-naught value going up.
The best illustration I had of exponential growth, I gave this on lunch last week, but like someone said that like if you go to your front door right now and you take an average step, like a 3-foot step, and then every step from here on out, you will double your stride. It's impossible, but imagine you could.
Right.
And you ask an average person, like, okay, after 30 steps, where would you be? And a lot of people, like, you know, I'm in Cincinnati, so let's say I started stepping west. An average person might say, I'm at the Ohio state border, or I'm at the Rocky Mountains, or
get extreme. I'm in Africa.
Yeah, I'm in Africa. It's actually that 30th step you would take, like, 23 trips around the world. It gets out of hand, and the R-naught value at 0 is not spreading at all. If it's under 1, it's decreasing, and anything over 2 triggers that exponential growth, and it gets worse and worse the higher it goes. Some things like measles, for example, have an R-naught value of 14. It's ridiculous how fast they spread.
Wow.
And which is why fucking vaccines for that are very, very important.
Yes.
So R-naught, some people think the R-naught is like a some kind of value that the virus itself has, and it does contribute. Like, so for example, Ebola has a very low R-naught because it can only spread through direct human-to-human contact with body fluids. So if you're dealing with a dead body, if you're dealing with, treating someone that's ill, you're touching their body. But if you stay 3 feet away from an Ebola person, it's not going to spread very fast. Also, Ebola is symptomatic almost as soon as you get it. There's a very short incubation period. Also, Ebola, the virus, is very, very fragile. Once it gets outside of the confines of a human body, moisture, oxygen, sunlight, all are like this thing that it's like a fucking vampire. It just instantly disintegrates this thing. So it's got a very low R value, even though its mortality is very, very high. It's like somewhere between 40 and 60%. If you catch Ebola, you got a 50-50 chance of whether you're going to beat it or not. But it's not intrinsic to the disease because, so let's say that Corona has an R-naught of 2.5 because the things that are really bad about Corona is you have a very long incubation time where you're infectious, but you're not showing symptoms. And there's not a lot of visible, like this MEV-1, people's faces were flushed. They had white shit coming around. They were foaming at the mouth.
And they were dead within, 12 to 24 hours of contracting it.
Whereas Corona, if it really takes a hold of you, you're sick for weeks. And if you go to a hospital, you're going to be on a ventilator for weeks. And if you recover, it's going to take a much, much longer time. So Also, it seems like the coronavirus is much hardier. It can survive on like a steel surface for up to 3 days. Again, in optimal conditions. And it can spread invisibly. So that's why it's tougher. But it's also different in that its death rate, as far as we can tell, is somewhere around 1% if you have medical care. And that shoots up to up to 5% if the hospitals start to get overrun and people have to make decisions about who gets ventilators. Because if you get this and it gets in your lungs, the only way you survive is to be mechanically ventilated until your body can clear it. And that can take a week or two. So if this was like as easily spread as corona and was as lethal as Ebola, you wouldn't have to tell people to stay home. People would be barricading themselves in their houses. Nurses and doctors would flee their hospitals. Like, that's, you know, you would have a full on like the whole world would stop working until this thing burnt itself out naturally. And that, I think this was interesting. This MEV1 was kind of like halfway between corona and Ebola.
Yeah.
It's got the spread of corona, and it's got like half the lethality of Ebola, so people took it very, very, very serious. Mm-hmm. So anyway, like in this film, in 12 days, 8 million people are infected. That seems very unrealistic to me, because if you compare that to corona, I don't think we've even had 1 million people worldwide infected, have we?
Yeah, and they're kind of like trying to get their hands around that through the whole movie, or get their heads around it to understand, okay, what are we dealing with here? And I think that's where the R-naught value really shoots through the roof, because initially they diagnosed it as like, this is an R-naught of 2, and we know we're dealing with an exponential sort of runaway effect, but eventually by the end of the movie they've upgraded it to an R-naught
of 4. Plus the movie, or the virus mutated, I think, increasing its spreadability. Now there's another piece of... Because a lot of people have played the game Plague Inc., where you have a virus and you try to kill everybody in the world. And when viruses mutate in that game, everyone that's infected in the virus gets the same mutation. All right? That's not how real life works. Like, if we have COVID-19 and we had a COVID-19B, and let's say its R value is twice as high because now it can spread through the air and not just on fomites and direct person-to-person contact. It's not like everyone in the world with COVID would now suddenly get upgraded to that. That would be a separate strain that would start with a single patient. You'd have, you know, patient zero, and it would have to spread throughout the ecosystem just like COVID did in the first place. So, like, if this thing mutated and became more lethal or higher to spread, we still have the opportunity to contain that from day one, just like we had the opportunity to contain coronavirus from day one. And hopefully we take it more seriously, especially if it mutated to get worse.
And hopefully we'd be more prepared for it as well.
Yeah, yeah. But I think all of these reasons kind of together. Also, like this coronavirus, it seems like it only attacks, it seems like it preferentially attacks the older and the immunocompromised. It attacks the lungs, it doesn't this, whereas the MEV1 was like a combination hemorrhagic fever where your brain actually turned to soup and it was killing your lungs.
Yeah.
And as a combination of things, it doesn't seem like coronavirus will ever be as bad as what happens in this movie with MEV, where you have mass graves. No. But we see places in Italy where they have hospitals with just rooms full of coffins waiting to be cremated, and people can't say goodbye because they're under quarantine and you can't have funerals. Yeah. And I read a lot of interviews of people where that's just a really tough thing to deal with.
I was going to say I can imagine, but I don't know that I can. Right. I've never seen anything like that. But we're going to see a lot of people dead. And really, whether or not we see sort of like mass graves and the kind of apocalyptic stuff that we're dealing with in this film depends on our response to this and how quickly we can ramp up our healthcare systems and our infrastructure to deal with the influx of sick and dying people that we know is coming.
Right.
It doesn't seem like we're doing much in that regard currently, but I don't know. We'll get there as a world, certainly. A global population will get there.
Yeah, if you do some quick back in the envelope calculations and you go with you know, an R value of like 2, and you go with like kind of what we're doing now, which is not much, like some states doing, I think, the bare minimum that you should do. But there's 2/3 of states not doing anything. A lot of experts are saying that it's not unlike it's not unrealistic to assume that 50% of the population will get this. And if you can go with a conservative death rate, that's 1.6 million people dead in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And which we're just not equipped to deal with.
No, and it's also, you're talking 40, 50 million dead across the world, which is easily Spanish influenza numbers.
It's World War II numbers. It's
And the problem with that is that, like, if that happens, that spike happens all at once, then those numbers become like 3, 4, 5%. Now you're looking at 8 to 10 million Americans dead. Yeah. That's where you might start seeing mass graves, mass crematoriums, stuff like that, because you just, you're not going to be able to deal with the influx on either the input on the hospital side, which is why the death rate will shoot up, nor right. on the putting people in the ground or getting them disposed of in other ways. That's why it's really important to, like, if you... We spread the virus does not. If a person, a healthy person, stays home and doesn't have a contact with another person, the R value of corona for them is zero.
Yeah.
And it's also a falsehood that everyone has to do the smart thing for the R value to plummet. 538 posted a poll where something like 76% of Americans are saying they are isolating, they are canceling plans. It should be higher, but that itself will make the R factor go down. And if we can get under one, that means we'll have a steadily decreasing caseload. And if we can keep it under two, that means it won't be spreading at a exponential rate, which is very important.
And the more we can do on that front, the faster that'll happen. We'll be right back after this short break.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for podcasts that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
So I want to talk about some similarities between Corona and MEV1, because the one thing I think that seemed to be a factor in MEV1 is it broke out during Thanksgiving in the United States, during the holiday season, when people right. are traveling all over the country, and COVID-19 suffered its initial outbreak in the lead up and during the Chinese New Year, where you yeah. had similar concerns. And what do you think the United States would do? Because it's actually interesting in research. I didn't know this 2 weeks ago, but the so-called Spanish flu, they think started in an army stockyard in Kansas. That's the original infection vector.
Okay.
And it was called the Spanish flu because Spain was a neutral country in World War I, and they were one of the only countries that were actively producing statistics about how many people were sick, how many people were dying. So every time you read something in a paper, it was Spanish doctors say, Spanish victims, Spanish death toll, and so it became known as the Spanish flu.
Right.
Do you think if something like coronavirus was identified in the United States in early to mid-October, with the importance that Black Friday has in our economy, do you think that the American government, the American corporations, the American people would be Johnny on the spot, or would there be a whole bunch of, you can't shut, it's Thanksgiving, people are going to see, it's Christmas, it's this.
I mean, we're still doing that. We're still doing that. We're talking about opening this fucking economy back up on Easter. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Oh, and I'm just
wondering. This thing is in no way under control, and every doctor on the planet is saying it.
Right. So it's like, to me, like, there's some deflection about like how bad the Chinese reaction to this, how they suppressed information. I have zero confidence that if the outbreak was in our country, that we would have handled it significantly better.
I mean, from what I understand, they've done some pretty admirable things, too. I mean, yes. You know, aside from squashing this thing, flattening the curve, they have also, back in January, they were the ones to sequence the DNA of this thing and release that for public use. Like, they've done some really important things also.
So, yeah, I mean, like, I think the Chinese government, the way they handled it can be criticized as all... I mean, absolutely. Hopefully at the end of all this, we can do a 360-degree analysis and own up to all of our sins and work together as a global community that we are... We pretend we're not, but we are, and try to make sure that nothing like this happens again.
I mean, it's impossible to pretend again now that this has happened that we are not a global community. I mean, look at the interconnected nature of everything. It's impossible to ignore at this point, and if you do so, you're just willfully ignorant.
Yeah. Well, and we have a lot of willful ignorance. I thought that's another similarity between Corona and MEV1 is that you looked at the media covering it. They had the head doctor of the CDC on a TV show debating this Jude Law conspiracy theory character. And yeah. I see this like this both sides. No respect for science. Only concerned with like profit and economic concerns. Gotcha moments. Like I see this a lot. And you see it with, I don't know, some of these press conferences we see at the federal government are just bizarre to me. Where they're like celebrations of corporations and what they're doing and it's telling people that it's not that big a deal and the cure is just around the corner and, you know, not listening to doctors and experts. And
this movie is prescient. It's amazing how closely this movie tracks with our real life response to this.
Right.
It's, of course, a much worse disease in the movie, but the response is almost identical.
There's a couple other similarities that I think are kind of unhelpful or hypocritical, kind of in the vein of the Chinese New Year thing. You hear a lot about these open air wet markets. And it reminds me a lot during the Ebola outbreak. Everyone is worked themselves up about like bushmeat and bushmeat markets, like these highly exotic, like you get the dinner scene in Temple of Doom, where they just open up monkey brains and fucking eating live eels and shit. And I actually agree with some of the criticism. It seems like some countries could do better to maintain health and sanitary standards in some of these wet markets, but. Wet markets happen in Asia, they happen in India, they happen in Europe. Cincinnati here, Findlay Market, is a wet market. People have raw meat that they are slinging in a confined, closed place. And I find it really interesting that people look down at their noses at countries that, you know, are having these open-air wet markets when scientists will say one of the big health risks in the world is our Western-style factory farming, where we cram... Yeah. Thousands of pigs and hundreds of thousands of chickens together in damp, dark, humid, filthy conditions. And these farmers, because you can't, that's not natural and sustainable. Like you would lose entire crops to disease because of course you would. It's a fucking living petri dish, but they soak everything in antibiotics, including antibiotics of last resort. Like these are the last antibiotics we have to stop some of these bugs, and they're spraying on pigs and chickens to increase the productivity. Any scientist would say, that is, if you predict a global outbreak, it's going to come from factory farming. It's going to come from one of these open air wet markets. Why can we judge an entire community, an entire civilization, entire culture of people for one thing, but yet turn a blind eye to what we're doing in our own country?
Yeah, and when you compound that with our other eating habits, such as extraordinarily processed foods, that are giving us diabetes and heart disease at just exorbitant rates, never seen in the world. then you have set up the perfect scenario for which into which to introduce a virus that's going to kill as many people as possible.
Yeah, and also like
because one of the complicating factors on this thing is diabetes on COVID-19.
Yeah.
So like you are far more likely, and it's why I think we're seeing so many people start to die in this country, because we have a really poor food system here that is causing us to be sickly in the first place.
Just in terms of nutrition, baseline nutrition and health, yeah.
Right. And so when something like this hits us, our immune systems aren't prepared to deal with it. They're not up to the standard.
Yeah. The other thing I think is really hypocritical is people are saying, well, the Chinese government, they try to deny this stuff. They try to minimize it. And this is all true. But you realize we live in a country where it's illegal to go into one of these facilities and film the conditions that these pigs and chickens are into. It's illegal to study it as an epidemiologist. Mm-hmm. Like these industry have lobbied for laws to make it to where these are black boxes. They're like, well, you know, animals go in and meat comes out and what happens inside them is none of your fucking business. And like, how the hell can you criticize a government for trying to keep information from people, keep information from the global community when we're letting this happen in the United States? And again, I'm not a vegetarian. I'm not a vegan. I just am a person that fucking hates hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. And I am so sick to death of hearing what I think is it's definitely got some kind of like racist culturalist tones that we, you know, like, oh, it's all about this bushmeat. It's all about this wet market. And it's like the Bible says, you know, pick out the rafter in your own eye before you go picking out straws in your neighbor's. Maybe we should keep our side of the street clean. Maybe then we could speak from a moral high ground to the rest of the world for once. But right now we're not doing that. The other one I thought was interesting is this movie makes a point that like there's this conspiracy theory about the Americans working in secret with the World Health Organization to develop a vaccine exclusively for Americans.
Yeah.
And it was widely reported from credible sources that our federal government did in fact make overtures to companies in Germany to secure an American-only vaccine for the virus. I'm actually surprised that that story went away as fast as it did.
Yeah, I'm trying to decide how I feel about this. How egregious is this? Because like it is the interest of every government to protect its people.
True.
And so if you have a vanishingly small number of vaccines, even after you get the vaccine tested and everything, and you have a vanishingly small number, of course you're going to give those to your people first. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It would almost be more shocking to me that a German company would sell us anything, would say, yes, you can have this for any amount of money, because they also have that same responsibility to their people.
This is where we still have that fuzz. Like we are like I mentioned before, like we are a global community, but we deny it. Like we put these false borders. This is something like many astronauts have remarked that like when you look at the planet as a whole, there are no borders, but we pretend we artificially carve things up and we treat like, I think you're right. In our current system, the American government has a responsibility to the American people first and foremost, especially since there's so many radical forms of different governments at very different levels of legitimacy, different levels of preparation, different levels of being able to contribute to the solution or become part of the problem. But I do also hope, I have a dream that probably not in my lifetime, but maybe within several generations, we can get to the point where that would seem a very antiquated and provincial look, that like a class of people that live in a particular patch of dirt are more important and more deserving of a cure than any other person on the planet. We're not there yet.
I mean, I totally agree with you. We should not view any person or group of people as more important than another, but like at some point there becomes a logistical reality, right? Like we only have so many of these, who gets them?
Yeah.
And honestly, like I would say, probably the best use of a vaccine once we get it is to distribute it worldwide to the healthcare workers.
Right.
First and foremost, because that's going to do the most good for everyone.
Yeah.
I don't think that's how it's going to go. I think if America gets a vaccine first, they'll give it to their people first.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see.
What else do we want to talk about? I feel like that's most of the issues that I wanted to talk about with Corona and MEV1 and the movie itself. I guess the thing I want to end with is there's a lot of talk about opening this thing up on Easter. And I don't think that's going to happen, because the thing about Corona, since it has such a long incubation and infectious period, is that assuming the United States shut everything down right now and there was like a draconian, like Chinese style quarantine, we would expect, just like we saw in China, just like we saw in Italy, just like we've seen in various countries around the world, that the number of cases still would not peak until 14 days later.
Right.
So you're talking about, we see how things are going now, and we're doing very few things to actually spread that value. You're talking about opening up the economy at a time where this problem is going to be, in all likelihood, 10 times worse.
Yeah.
And you're going to start seeing the states that feel like they're safe, you know, the more sparsely populated countries, you're going to see them, or not countries, states, you're going to start seeing it get very real with them. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know. Like, you've got these people arguing that a depression is not worth, saving 3 million lives, for example.
Yeah.
And I guess I just don't see the case that there's anything we can do to avoid a financial meltdown at this point. Like, this is a given. If you let everyone go out and get sick, you overwhelm the hospitals, you're going to kill a million people. You're going to kill millions of people, and you're going to suffer extreme economic distress. Or you could suffer extreme economic distress and save millions of people. And it seems obvious to me what the solution is to that.
Yeah, I mean, completely foolish to think, okay, we can just tell everybody the economy's on again on Easter, and yet I can look at the stats and I can see that 10 times the people have died of this thing and it's still going up.
Yeah.
And that I'm going to walk outside of my house and I'm going to go get a cheeseburger at McDonald's.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. And I don't think I'm an exception in this case. I think there are many people who are just going to stay the fuck home, stay the fuck out of populated areas, regardless of what you tell them, until they see these stats under control.
Yeah, and if you're one of those that make the argument that 1-3% of people dying is acceptable, I would like for you to inventory 100 people that you know, that you care for, and pick 3 to die.
Yeah.
Like, how do you do that calculus? And the fact is, and that's the thing, is like, if you go this route, many more people than that are going to die, I'm convinced, because we just don't have the surge capacity to handle all these people. It's going to be exactly what happens in Italy, where doctors start making decisions based on who lives and who dies. So I hope that, and there are some initial signs that, you know, maybe we're going to get that they've got, like, you know, they pass this huge $2 trillion package to help people that are losing their jobs and that they're suffering economic distress. We have the money, we have the capability to take care of everybody. And if we do, and if we beat this thing, then the economy will be primed to be roaring back. It'll be like a backdraft situation where you've got an economy that was otherwise healthy, that has been starved of production. The people have been putting off, you know, buying new cars, upgrading their houses, consumer purchases, spending money on restaurants and stuff. There's going to be like as soon as we beat this thing, it'll be oxygen hitting that fire and we'll come roaring back. Mm-hmm. But like, it's whether we do that and lose 100 million people around the world or not.
Yeah.
Because there's no scenario in which. Because I think you're right. If they do relax everything in Easter, I know I'm not going to.
No.
I'm in a position. And like anyone, I think most people, once they see this thing really set in, and once, I don't know how many people are watching, like, what an Italian hospital in northern Italy looks like now. It's fucking ghastly.
Yeah.
And we're almost there in New York right now.
We are.
When that shit starts happening in countries across America, and that is on cable news 24/7, it's on your YouTube channels and shit, it's going to be a lot harder to be a 65-year-old senator saying, I'd die to save the economy for my grandkids. It's going to be a lot harder when the reality of people dying alone, gasping for air, sets in.
Yeah.
So, anyway, contagion.
Mm-hmm.
Worst case scenario, we're not staring down 1 out of 5 people with this dying, but it's weird. We're in this Goldilocks zone, kind of like, you know, how the Earth is in the perfect spot. It's not too hot, not too cold.
Yeah.
Like, this thing spreads fast enough, but is just not lethal enough that it's a giant problem. But people can kind of like probability it away. And
right,
like I said, if this thing was as lethal as Ebola, we wouldn't be having this conversation. And if it spread like Ebola, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But we're right there in the Goldilocks zone, which is good for the virus, bad for us. Anyway.
Yeah.
we're taking this seriously. We hope everybody in our community does too, and we do our part to make this disruption as short as we can and save as many people's lives.
Yeah,
I think that's important.
Hopefully when we get on the other side of this, we can start to make some structural changes to our society that will better equip us for the next round of this, because there will be a next round. It's almost inevitable. We just need to be prepared for that.
This is something you and I have talked about, like in lunches and this other kind of free range of podcasts, the way that there's a lot of doctors that talk like we might look back at the 20th century as this golden age of medicine where he essentially cured all diseases, because more and more we got bugs that are antibiotic resistant and we are out of antibiotics. Like, to beat them, we have to invent new antibiotics, and that's very hard. And we're going to have to, there's some promising work in like phage therapy where you can actually train your body to destroy these bugs. But there might be a gap of 20, 30, 40 years where stuff that we used to solve easily is going to start killing people again. And what do we do? What kind of medical framework, what kind of healthcare framework, what kind of economic framework do we have? If, you know, a lot of scientists are saying that like this permafrost freezes, we're going to unleash virus and bacteria that the world hasn't seen for 200,000-300,000 years. What is our plan to be able to isolate, identify, and attack those? Yeah, this is that Goldilocks might be a good in terms of a wake up call, that it's not strong enough to like just kick the shit out of us, but it's also too serious to ignore. Unlike things like Ebola and SARS and some of these other virus scares that we've had before that didn't, you know, kind of came and went and were contained, not because they were nothing, but because very hardworking people behind the scenes did the stuff that you see in this movie to prevent them from becoming a bigger problem.
And I think that's key. Like, we need to understand in this country that there are some experts you need to listen to. And science has given you everything that's good in your life. Everything. If you enjoy texting with your friends, science gave you that. Like, if you enjoy driving your car down the street, joyriding, science gave you that. Let's get back on board the science train, and let's understand that these scientists are not somehow our enemies or greedy and out there to make a whole bunch of money off their work. They are simply asking questions and trying to find answers. And when they find those answers, we should listen to them.
Yeah. If you're a betting man over the last several centuries, and if you bet on science and doctors and medicine, you would win 99 out of 100 times.
Right.
Because it's just not very often, especially the further we get in stream of time, that like an expert consensus, a scientific consensus, is going to be wholly overturned.
Yeah.
And I think we've lost sight of that like science has become some kind of optional thing or some kind of litmus test for your beliefs. Need to lose that, because it's going to kill people.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's our review of Contagion and the coronavirus. I give Contagion 10 out of 10. I give coronavirus -3 out of 10.
Yeah.
It's the fucking worst. Speaking of victims of the coronavirus, one of the victims is the James Bond franchise. We were really, really hyped to see No Time to Die. It was set to come out very, very soon. But because of this virus panic and the fact that, I shouldn't say panic, the warranted fear of this virus has caused mass gatherings to be banned and most movie theaters are closed down. It's been pushed out past Turkey Day. As Contagion would put it. But we're still kind of jonesing for some James Bond. We're jamesing for some Bond. And we noticed that Netflix has Goldeneye, the crown jewel in the Brosnan crown, I guess. The Bond collection. The first, the best one. Everyone probably that listens to this podcast has access to Netflix, or at least most of them. Let's all watch Goldeneye and celebrate this pretty good, pretty schlocky, very suave and sophisticated James Bond. We'll be talking about that next week on next Thursday, Goldeneye. So prep with it if you want, and we'll be back next week to talk about that and hopefully get ready for No Time to Die. Because man, No Time to Die is the first movie got pushed back. I'm like, ooh, that hurts.
Yeah,
I'm so hyped. Like, you know, Corey Fukunaga directing, Phoebe Waller-Bridge writing. Remy Malek in his giant eyes starring. It's got a lot of good stuff. So we'll be back next week for Goldeneye. Hope you enjoyed our talk about Contagion / coronavirus. Until next week, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Have a good one.